are scheduled for oral argument and one is not. As mentioned, I'm Judge Wheelock. I'm here with Judge Helbrecht today. Unfortunately, Judge Bjorkman is not able to be with us in person, but she is viewing the arguments via the live stream, and so not able to ask questions, but definitely invested in hearing you today. So with that, just a reminder that our arguments are recorded by the court, and the audio recordings are generally available on the court's website within 24 hours. So with that, Marshall, please call the first case before us.
The first case this morning is A24-1328, John Putz, appellant, versus Vernon Secrest, the second respondent.
And counsel, as you probably know, you each have 15 minutes for your primary argument, and counsel for appellant will have an additional 5 minutes of rebuttal. There is a way to adjust the podium if you need to before you begin. There is also a timer there. Please introduce yourself at the beginning of your argument and say who you're representing so we can get the pronunciation and have all of that available for our record. So with that, counsel for appellant, you can begin when you are ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Brian Lewis on behalf of Appellant John Putz. This case presents an essential one argument, whether the statute of limitations at play for incidents of medical malpractice is told during the pendency of a federal suit. If the answer to that question is yes, then the question of whether service was effective falls by the wayside. If the answer to that question is no, then the question would become, is service effective?
Mr. Lewis, may I just clarify? This was an argument you presented to the district court, but the district court did not really touch upon in its order.
That's correct, Your Honor. The district court essentially passed that question by in making its decision on the merits. In benefit of full transparency, there might be a way for this court to argue that the district court made implicit findings on that fact, but honestly, I believe that the implicit finding doctrine doesn't really help us here, because in order to decide a legal issue, the trial court below should make at least some sort of findings on that, so that way it's preserved really for this court's review to understand the logic behind.
Wondering if there are any disputed facts, though, and whether or not it would just simply be a question of law for this panel.
Your Honor, I think the only real dispute would be whether the statute of limitations was told, at least for the first step. If we go past the first step, then there are would be a question of fact as to whether service was effective, and of course, mixed questions of fact and law. There's the usual standard for that.
But in terms of dates that things occurred, at least those are undisputed.
I'm pretty sure that's correct, Your Honor. Nobody disputes that service was made on the date in the record. Nobody disputes whether the federal suit that's the subject of the tolling argument was done on certain dates. Those are essentially a matter of record.
Well, I don't want to interrupt you further, but I'm interested in this argument because it seems that the case law establishes that if something is ultimately determined on the merits, then tolling would apply. But my understanding is, in this case, the federal action was dismissed, not.
Your Honor, the question, I think yes and no. The merits were reached when the federal district court held that the appropriate that the prerequisites weren't met. My understanding of the case law surrounding that is that when the federal district court dismisses for not having met the appropriate prerequisites, that becomes a judgment on the merits. So even if I'm wrong on that, then the fact that the suit was ultimately dismissed after appeal should serve to show that this action was prosecuted, as we said in our brief, to its conclusion, whatever that was. And the Minnesota case law is kind of sparse dealing with whether a suit is told for during the pendency of a federal suit, especially in a circumstance where the doctor whose actions are the subject of suit is an employee or a contractor of the government, simply because the Federal Tort Claims Act requires that such a suit be brought in the name of the United States. The closest I think that this court has ever come to discussing federal tolling in that regard would probably be the Regents of University of Minnesota versus Rager. And even that is distinguishable because it concerns the 11th Amendment the application of the 11th Amendment, which isn't at play here. But for that, we believe that this court should hold that the statute was told because the federal suit was prosecuted to its end. The federal suit was timely. Nobody disputes that. The federal suit was fully, fairly prosecuted, regardless of what the end result was. The state court action depended on the same transaction and occurrence as the federal suit, regardless of the name in which the name of the defendant, whether it was United States or whether it was the respondent in this case. The tests for privity are met. So I am willing to entertain other questions of the court, if the court has any, or I'm willing to tender.
Oh, I guess I did have some questions about the discussion about the summons and complaint being defective. You were arguing that this voluntary acceptance of service somehow, that the email that was sent, but you would agree that the email wasn't sent until January 9th. Is that correct?
I believe that's the date on the email, Your Honor. I believe you're correct on that.
Okay. And you're basically relying on substantial compliance with the Rule 4.05 sub A. There were six separate requirements that you needed to meet in order to have that be effective. My understanding is you really only met one of those, or at least that's what the district court determined. So if that's the case, how do you get to substantial compliance?
Your Honor, substantial compliance, I don't believe, has ever been precisely defined as by this court. I also think that when the response was sent, even if it was sent outside of the date that was after, that would also get us, accepting your statement to two. And I think that in the circumstance where we're trying to serve an out-of-state defendant whose address we only know as a federal facility, substantial compliance, at least for purposes of serving a person who is out of the state working at a federal facility, can be met at one or even two of the factors.
What's your authority for that? What's your proposition?
Your Honor, to be perfectly honest, I would like you to expand the case law to say that.
Nothing right now.
No, Your Honor.
States it. Okay.
As I said, I'm pretty sure that, at least the way I remember it, that this court has said substantially complied and hasn't exactly narrowed down with what that means. Do you mean all six factors? Do you mean five of six? Whatever that number is. And this might be the opportunity, if the court finds that tolling doesn't apply, to say what that standard is, or at least what it is not.
Thank you,
Your Honor.
Okay, so we will have the clock reset for 15 minutes, and we'll turn to attorney for the respondent. Feel free to take a moment to adjust the podium if you wish, and
thank you.
Remember to introduce yourself and your client when you begin. And you may begin when you are ready.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jennifer Bovitz. I'm here today representing Dr. Vernon Sechrist II. There is no dispute in this case that appellant's medical malpractice case was subject to a four-year statute of limitations, subject to pursuant to Minnesota statute 541.076. There is no dispute in this case that appellant's claims accrued on January 2nd, 2020. There is no dispute that appellant's claims were time barred as of January 3rd, 2024.
Although it's a little curious, Ms. Bovitz, that the district court order talks about January 2nd or several days thereafter.
That's fair, Your Honor. But what is key in this case is that the summons and complaint related to my client, Dr. Sechrist, was not even mailed, which is not an effective form of service. So when we look at Rule 4 of the Rules of Civil Procedure, which governs service of process, and there is a dispute here. Appellant just told you that there is no dispute about service. There certainly is. That's what one of the issues this court is examining. There is absolutely a dispute about service.
I took his comment to mean no dispute about dates.
Fair. The complaint in this case was not deposited in the mail until January 2nd, 2024, to California. There is no possible way. Well, first, that wasn't effective service of process. And the language needs to be clear in this case, right? I mean, we're talking about service of process, and that you can't serve by mail in Minnesota anymore. That's not effective. What appellant needed to do was, what I think, I don't know what appellant was trying to do, but what if they were attempting to comply with the rules, they had to comply with Rule 4.05, and that didn't occur here. There was absolutely no compliance with Rule 4.05, and Rule 4.05 doesn't start the clock until Form 22B is returned and the date of that signature is returned. That did not occur here. So the statute of limitations, it was not met. It couldn't have been met. Even if we look at the date of my client's email, which is not a qualifier under Rule 4.05, it doesn't qualify. Kokosh and the other cases talk about that. Notice does not qualify as a waiver. It doesn't qualify under Rule 4.05. So the statute of limitations was not met, and the claim is time barred. So, correct. The issue is whether the statute was told as a result of this defective federal lawsuit. And so I think it is important for the court to understand the history and the procedural history of the nature of that federal lawsuit in examining this case. And it's important to know that that case was defective, and it was reached on the merits, as appellant points out, and it was also defective because they missed timing and other procedural deadlines too, but it was a decision on the merits.
It was dismissed for lack of subject matter jurisdiction.
Correct. So what happens is on January 3rd, 2022, appellant presents an administrative claim to the Department of Veterans Affairs because that's how these claims start. On January 7th, 2022, appellant was put on notice that the Federal Torts Claims Act does not govern independent contractors. And that's important here, I think, to the extent that this court has concerns about equity, which I don't know that that's an appropriate concern for this court, but appellant was put on notice as of January 7th, 2022, that the Department of Veterans Affairs was making a claim that Dr. Sechrest was an independent contractor, and that claims about Dr. Sechrest within the claim made to the Department of Veterans Affairs were not appropriate. On February 28th, 2022, the Veterans Affairs Department informed appellant that it deemed Dr. Sechrest an independent contractor, not an employee. So as of February 28th, 2022, appellant was fully aware of that claim by the Department of Veterans Affairs and could have very easily instituted a state lawsuit and did not.
Is all of that information that you just recited, is that in the record before us?
Yes.
Okay.
On May 10th, 2022, appellant's claim was denied by the VA, and then on November 9th, 2022, appellant filed a suit against the United States in the District of Minnesota. So again, the party there that's named is the United States, not Dr. Sechrest. One thing appellant didn't mention is the claim against the United States. While it involves care received at the VA, it's not just care by my client, it's care by other people at the VA as well. Nurses, physician's assistants. It's not just care by Dr. Sechrest. On June 26, 2023, June 27, 2023 is when judgment was entered, but Judge Nelson signed the order on June 26, 2023. I know you care about when the judgment is entered, so that's why I mentioned June 27, 2023. There was the dismissal order for lack of jurisdiction. And the important piece there is appellant, again, failed to present the claim properly because the administrators that presented the claim were not identified as proper representatives. The dismissal was affirmed by the Eighth Circuit on April 23rd, 2024. And then we don't have this state complaint, any action on it, until it's deposited in the mail until January 2nd, 2024.
Can I just ask you to clarify for me, who were the named defendants in the federal action?
The United States of America. But it encompassed care by many people at the VA.
And included the facility itself?
Yes. So the concern here is appellant, in terms of this tolling argument, has not cited any precedent that allows this court to make legal findings that, in fact, a federal lawsuit that is alleged against a wholly separate party tolls a state action. There is no law that says that, nor does any of the law that appellant cites get this court there. What I heard appellant just ask this court is for this court to make new law. That is very clearly what appellant just asked this court to do. And respectfully, that's not this reviewing court's role. So based on the law that this court has, there is no basis to find that appellant's claim was in fact tolled. And the district court was well within her discretion to rule on the motion to dismiss and find that appellant's client claim was time barred because the statute of limitations had in fact run. And Mercer versus Anderson makes it clear that when service of process has not been effectuated, as it wasn't here, was not properly, there was no service of process, the district court has the ability, has the jurisdiction to consider the motion to dismiss, which in fact it did here, finding that there was no appropriate basis for the claim and that decision should be affirmed.
Just another clarifying question for me, Ms. Bovitz. So we do have cases that involve, not again, the federal government, but other parties where it talks about, the tolling is only effective if a case is prosecuted to final judgment. But is it your position that those cases don't apply here? They do not support your position because they don't involve the federal government?
Help me understand your question again.
Sure. For example, there's a case against a school district in 1990. These are state court
Sherrick,
matters.
right?
Exactly.
Sherrick, yes.
And another one, you know, DeMars versus Robinson King Flores. They seem to say that you have to prosecute an action to final judgment if there is to be a tolling argument that is effective. And so I expected you to, you know, take the position that those supported your position, that they were good authority for what you're arguing. But I understood your argument to be a little more nuanced, that you were saying we don't have anything that involves the federal government where that was a similar legal premise.
Both of those things are true. Okay, so both of those things are true. So the parties here were different. So the federal government was named. My client wasn't named. Appellant was certainly on notice and had the ability to bring this state suit sooner, to the extent the court is concerned about equity. And Sherrick and Ragnar and DeMars do not support appellant's position whatsoever for the reasons you just stated. So all of those things are mutually true. In addition, Sherrick and DeMars involved the same parties. So within those cases, they involved the same individuals, the same actions were involved in those lawsuits. DeMars was an unemployment case. Sherrick, as you mentioned, were teachers with a dispute about with a seniority list, and they were named in the different actions. Again, within the state court and the workers' compensation cases were positioned a little bit differently, but they were the same parties named. Clearly distinguishable here.
Thank you.
The district court was well within its discretion. I want to be careful about that, because motions to dismiss are reviewed on an abuse of discretion, but your standard of review here is de novo, because these are questions of law. When you are reviewing the application of the rules of civil procedure, as well as the statute of limitations issues here, when you apply the law and the precedent we have, the outcome is clear that the order of the district court should be affirmed, and I would be happy to take any additional questions or answer any clarifying procedural issues as well.
Okay, I think we're good. Thank you. And we will turn to counsel for appellant for the last word. There are 5 minutes on the clock. You can adjust the podium and begin when you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. One of the curses of being tall is you're constantly adjusting things. Brian Lewis on behalf of John Putz, Your Honors. Some of the problems with the respondent's position is that an administrative body, the VA, as she rightly said, made a decision that the respondent was a contractor. But the U.S. Code provides a remedy if a person who's injured doesn't agree with that, and that remedy is to file a suit in the federal district court. And under the Federal Tort Claims Act, the proper respondent is the United States. At that time, our position was that Dr. Sechrest was not a contractor, and we made those arguments in the federal district court. The federal courts ultimately disagreed, but that's the job of the federal court system, is to say if the agency's determinations were correct. You know, at that point, that's the job of the federal courts, is to say the VA was right or wrong. If this court were to accept the position put forth by the respondent, that would eviscerate an injured party's right to appeal to the federal courts, because their position would be that we're bound to the VA determination and the clock starts at that point. That eviscerates the whole point of judicial review. And that is bad policy for any number of reasons. And I'm sure I don't need to state any of those reasons here, where this court's reviewed medical malpractice actions. And just to clarify, Judge Hallbrooks was correct that my comment earlier on the confusion about dates, we're talking strictly the dates, not the not anything else. So I appreciate the Judge Hallbrooks making that statement. The other problem is that if this court were to start the clock again at the time that the VA's decision was made, or even if this court started the clock at the point the district court judgment was made, that's not a final decision on the merits. The final decision on the merits would be what the Eighth Circuit held, and that restarted the clock. At the end of the day, No matter how we view the service, right, wrong, or sideways, the clock was told while the federal lawsuit went in our view. And for that reason, we would urge this court to reverse the decision of the district court, holding that the statute was told, and remand for further proceedings not inconsistent with the court's opinion here.
Counsel, just to clarify something that you began with when you started your initial argument, is it your position that if the statute was not in fact told, we do not reach the issue, the first issue that was briefed, just sort of thinking about the order of arguments of whether the service was effective to confer jurisdiction?
I'll restate it a slightly different way, Your Honor, just to make sure that we're on the same page. My position, or appellant's position, is that the first question to be reached is, was the statute told? If yes, then it's told. And if the statute was not told, then we look, at least in our view, too, was service effective. Now, the other side of it is, if it's told and this court then decides that for reasons that service wasn't effective, then it would be remanded for whatever period was whatever reason was told, and then presumably there would be a second bite at the apple, so to speak. But that's the way I view the order of decisions. Does that answer Your Honor's question?
Yeah, it does. Thank you.
I have nothing further. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel for argument here today, as well as the briefing. We have reviewed that, and we will consider all of it. We consider the case submitted, and the decision will be issued within the 90-day statutory timeframe. Thank you.